But tonight I'm honored to have here Aya Savana, who is the prioress of Awakening Forest Hermitage for Buddhist monastic women. She has been to our store, I think, on two previous occasions, and we had a wonderful conversation, a spontaneous sharing of the Buddha Dhamma, and we suggested that she give a talk here, and she very gratefully acquiesced. And tonight, she will be talking about meditation for deep healing and samadhi. Thank you so much for coming to Many Rivers. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Let's start a little chanting. If you know the words, you can join me. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So praise for the sublime one, the worthy one, the fully enlightened one. That's the man who 2,600 years ago realized the escape from the prison of the ego, who realized that ultimate peace and freedom, which is, in my mind, the highest kind of happiness that a human being can aspire to. It was because of encountering some bhikkhus who exemplified that sense of great personal freedom and great joy at a time about 25 years ago when my life was rather troubled and very burdened with all kinds of problems and difficulties, the usual stuff. And I just noticed this freedom and wanted to find out more about it, learn more about it, had the attraction from that early time to follow what these men were demonstrating so beautifully. One of the first things that happened, I took a little class on the Dhamma, and it was the room was warm, it was kind of dark. The teaching was given in a very soothing and mellifluous voice, and every Thursday or something, I would go after work to this this course and promptly fall asleep. I slept through the first, eight steps of the Eightfold Noble Path. I think there might be a chair somewhere. And then, I apologized to the teacher because it seemed almost a little bit insulting to just go and conk out immediately after every class after class. And he just said, "Well, there's something in your life that you're very tired of," and he had no ego investment. See, there was not any of this reactivity coming from his pride or his conceit or his sense of his value. There was nothing but kindness and sympathy, and that was the thing that ultimately led me many years later to myself try to go into this same path, which seemed to me to be the easiest, most direct, and straightforward way to obtain the kind of realization that was being presented. I do think that this path that I've chosen is easier than the path that you all have chosen. you have got a complicated life with a lot of different kind of demands on your time and your loyalty and different things to worry about, different relationships to worry about. You're out here in the world subjected to capitalism. You're being brainwashed every day almost by the media who are intentionally trying to make you anxious because that's a method for getting you to buy more things. You're subjected to people who are powerful that are also attempting to manipulate you. And it's because of all those difficulties that in the olden days, young men and young women would sometimes make this statement that the home life is very dusty, but the life of a recluse is the life of freedom. And for that reason, they decided to go forth and undertake the life of a samana, of a homeless mendicant person who has no purpose except to obtain spiritual liberation. After I had gotten into this path and actually gotten into the robes, I found out that in this day and age, in the 20th century, in my branch of Buddhism, the Theravada, there are a number of difficulties, particular difficulties facing women, so that it's only by a miracle that there's now an opportunity for a woman who has this kind of aspiration to have an ability in the Theravada to get into robes, to get proper spiritual guidance and training, and to be able to have a place to practice. 30 years ago, everyone thought this form, this bhikkhuni form, died out 900 years ago, and impossible to revive it. So women will just have to be like the auxiliary in some different type of status without having the full opportunity to pursue liberation through this particular channel. Times are changing. Now we have ordination of bhikkhunis. I think the first one who did was in 1988 with Ayakema and some other women who ordained at that time. It didn't really take hold and become a living, successful tradition that women could come and join regularly. In 1996 and 1998, something started in Sri Lanka. I was able to go when my turn came. I could be sent to Sri Lanka to obtain the ordination through the guidance of my teacher. And now, since last year, we have ordinations. This is the picture of my monastery. And four women are taking the full Upasampada ordination. This is over here in Jenner, California, at the Aranyabodhi Hermitage, or the Awakening Forest Hermitage. We have in this picture the four new nuns getting receiving their ordination. We have a sangha of five bhikkhunis who are primarily Americans who came together from different parts of the USA. And then we have behind them another nine bhikkhus who came together from five different monasteries around this area. So the Wat down in Fremont, the Vyagiri Monastery, the Sri Lankan Monastery in Santa Clara, the Sri Lankan Monastery in in Sacramento, and my own teacher from his monastery in West Virginia, all came together to do this, to support this ordination. It's kind of a miracle. And on the side here in brown robes, there are two nuns from the what's called Sila Dara tradition who have trained under Ajahn Sumedho all these years and who have not had access to full ordination. They've had monastic training without having the formal status as a bhikkhuni, and these women will be trained under our sponsorship this fall. Okay. Now it's happening. It's in America. You don't have to go to Asia. If somebody wants to follow this path, the way is open. The space is here. This is one of the things that we do. But the most important thing we're doing over there, up north of Jenner, we've got our hermitage. We're trying to provide a proper place of practice. And this is something that is also a tremendous challenge for women, to have a supportive, decent environment for them to be able to train themselves and to have the time and space to develop their own meditation, their own awakening. It's very difficult to be a Buddhist monastic in America. America is like a sponge. It's a very, very dry, thirsty, hungry sponge that wants monastic teachers. The day that I got ordained, I was invited to... not the day I got ordained, but a few months after I got ordained, I was invited to teach a 10-day retreat. We could ordain, put this robe on, and get in an airplane and go from conference to conference, retreat center to retreat center, giving retreats and teaching, and then organizing ordinations, doing administrative work, and be as busy as we ever were in lay life, and not really have the opportunity to get our maturity so that we have something proper to offer you. So then the hermitage that we're making is attempting to be a place where women can have the space for their own growth, for their own quietude, and for their own development, for our own happiness. Which brings me to the theme of tonight's talk, which is the theme of metta. And what is metta? Except the sincere intention for our own happiness and for the happiness of everybody. For the happiness of all sentient beings without any distinction or any difference. At the most profound or deepest way that we're able to conceptualize what happiness really is. I invite you to think about this just for a moment. What is it to be happy? What is real, true happiness? The simple happiness of petting your dog or having Christmas or seeing your loved ones is part of happiness. And then the more long-term kind of happiness, which is involved with some type of an idea of the good life, of a life which has got some kind of ethical stability, some kind of balance, some kind of autonomy, some kind of freedom. The good life is also part of happiness, right? And then, at the end, the happiness that we're really striving for, the spiritual happiness, is one where we realize the unconditioned, where we understand that in those moments when we're able to let go of all the complications, all the negativities, all the problems, that actually inside this mind or inside this heart, the happiness is already there. That this very blissful, pure, equanimous state is within us all the time, It was always there. We just had to find out how to make space, to make room, to allow this pure happiness to grow and to shine. Another way of thinking of happiness is there's a type of happiness that's more excited. It depends on, actually it depends on pain or suffering. So if I am coming up to my lunchtime as one who only eats one meal in a day, I'm possibly hungry. The blood sugar is low. I might feel a little tired or a little, you know, slightly queasy or something, or not well. And then the smell of the wonderful food that some person has very kindly prepared to offer and give to me is so pleasing and so beautiful. And that's really just the body telling me that soon this trouble is going to be over. So that happiness is actually the flip side of suffering. It's completely dependent on suffering, right? There's no sauce better than hunger, right? There's no love that is sweeter in a certain way than after you've had a quarrel, and then you make up, and both of the people in the relationship really, really, really want to make it good because they really want to forget about the argument that they finished having. The happiness which depends on suffering is something that has a lot of instability to it. And it's something that is very short-lived and is actually, the pain is right inside of that happiness. It feels like a lot of fun, but it's really just a momentary thing. And that's not the real deal. When they speak, there's a lot in the old suttas about what's translated as a sensual pleasure, which is more or less looked down on as being something that only people who don't know about meditation, when they're in pain, they go to sensual pleasure because that's the only escape that they know from their painful situation. And I believe that actually the true happiness is also sensual in the sense that we experience it with our body, and we experience it with our senses. We experience it with the sense of the mind. But when they talk about sensual pleasure, that's the pleasure that's this roller coaster thing, that's depending on escaping from our suffering. And that's okay for what it is, but it's not what we're really looking for. The other kind of happiness is related to equanimity. So the equanimous mind has got a very pleasant aspect. So that's in the sequence of how our spiritual progress goes. If you find something that works, you find a way out, there can be this sense of excitement, and then it settles down, and there's a tranquility of the body, and that settles down some more, and then there's something that's just called just happiness. It's a luminous experience in the mind that has that quality of stability that is not dependent on something outside. It's just something that belongs to you. Okay. So this is where the practice of metta begins. It's by trying to get in touch with that particular type of happiness, trying to find a way to evoke it, to call it up reliably, to pervade every cell in your body with the feeling connected to that true happiness, and then to be able to give it out, to spread it out. How many have practiced what's called metta meditation or loving kindness meditation before? almost everybody. How many have practiced what's called vipassana or mindfulness? Almost everybody. It's very typical in a meditation retreat to start before sitting down to a session of meditation and to spend some minutes with developing the thought of metta, the wish for metta. It may be some type of sequence of ideas or something like a prayer. The one that my teacher taught me is very wordy. It's, may I be well, happy, and peaceful. May no harm come to me. May no difficulties come to me. May no problems come to me. May I always meet with success. May I also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. And then, may my parents be well, happy, and peaceful. May no harm come to them. May no difficulties come to them. May no problems come to them. May they always meet with success. May they also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable problems, difficulties, and failures in life. And then it goes on through all the different categories of people and down to your worst enemy. And then from there out to all beings. What we're doing there is we're establishing a very wholesome volition or an intention, the intention of non-harming, the intention for the welfare of ourselves and for the other beings. And that is the way of clearing away some of the agitation or whatever tightness we're holding, so that then when we sit down to go into vipassana meditation, we would go into it in a more open and relaxed way. But the form of metta meditation that I've been working with for the past several years is taking it in a little bit different direction than you might have heard about before. Instead of starting with metta and then going to vipassana, the suggestion is to start with vipassana practice and then do the metta second. The reason for starting with vipassana is to develop an awareness of the feelings in the body, to be able to be very present, to sit for some time. There's several different kinds of formats or particular guided meditations and different methods that are given for this, to methodically scan through the body, to do some relaxation, to notice the sensation on the skin and the sensations inside the body from head to toe, to just be awake and alert, to know where any tension or any holding is, and perhaps to release that tension, to notice where the pain is, and to stop fighting with the pain, instead just to allow it and relax around any painful things going on in the body. And in particular, for the sake of metta meditation, I'm interested in suggesting that you would become sensitized to the visceral parts of the body, the parts of the body connected to emotions, because metta, you know, Ayakema says that she loves to call it love, because that gets like the strength and the power of it, whereas you should say loving friendliness, that seems a little bit more abstract. Feeling of, like, if you were a mother and you had a baby and you pick up your baby, right? or if you think of yourself when you were a baby and you hold yourself, imagine this, that you hold yourself, you pick up a little like a doll. It's you when you were small, when you were completely innocent, when you hadn't made any of your mistakes yet. And look at that little one, and you just want them to be happy. Nothing matters, except you just want them to be happy. Okay. Now, how does that feel inside? Doesn't that stir something? So we do this mindful awareness of the body to be sensitized in the heart, in the belly, in the blood, to know what the emotion is that's connected with the method practice. This is something that you don't hear a lot from some of the teachers, especially the Theravada teachers. This is why they need bhikkhunis, because they're all these men, and there's a lack of appreciation for the value of emotion in our practice. But actually, what the Blessed One did, he didn't just point to this mountaintop. Okay, there's Mount Everest over there, and you can look at the snowy peak of Mount Everest and say that's enlightenment, and you could say, okay, so go there. And so we're down here in the swamp, you know, trying to drain the swamp and fight the alligators or something like that. And we can look up and we can see this thing over there, but we don't know how to get from A to B. What the Buddha did was he gave, through this skillful means of his teaching, he always gave these paths. There's many, many different pathways in the old text where the Buddha started with things that are completely normal, completely ordinary, things that we have today, things that everybody has. Even if they never heard anything about wisdom teachings, they have within themselves a mixture of the wholesome, beneficial, and useful qualities and traits and attributes, and then some other attributes that are not so useful, not so wholesome. And the Buddha would point to, take these things, take the ones that are the wholesome ones, and cultivate those, and that's going to be your ladder. So you learn how to cultivate and allow what you naturally have, which is wholesome, and you learn how to just let go of the things that are not so helpful. I heard this recently. Ajahn Chah said it's about anger and upset and distress. He said it's like a stick. You just take a stick and just throw it in the bush and walk away. That's what you learn to do with your anger, your jealousy, your pride, your arrogance, all of the things that are not helping you. You just throw them away, forget about them. But then take the ones that are beneficial, helpful, this pure love that doesn't care, compassion that knows how to help when somebody else is suffering, or that when there's something in you that's suffering, that wisdom factor that you can be your own parent and know how to help, that mudita, that sympathetic joy, that rejoices whenever we see goodness anywhere, whether it belongs to us or not, whenever we see success, and then that equanimity that allows and gives freedom, which is contented and satisfied and non-judgmental, that accepts everything. Those are the things that you can help. And you already have them, even if you didn't know anything about Buddhism, you've got these qualities, these attributes. So, in this metta practice, what you're going to do is learn to practice vipassana. You already know how to do this. Be able to locate the feelings in the body and to be mindfully aware of the feelings. Once you've become settled particularly on feelings in the body, particularly the visceral feelings, maybe center in, come to the heart area, or somewhere where the emotions live. And then bring in your phrase of metta. But don't do that whole long paragraph I gave you before. Just do something really, really simple. Something like, may I be happy. And start with yourself. And don't yet go to this whole list of all the people in the world. Just think of your own happiness. Think of what it really means for you to be, really be happy in the more deeper and profound way. And what it would mean for you to protect your happiness, to care for your happiness, to just do what was supportive for happiness, not to do nothing that was hindering your happiness. So you've taken a few minutes of what we could call like thinking meditation to be aware of the meaning. So this phrase that you're using, this may I be happy, may I be well, may I be peaceful, that phrase is not just a mantra, it's full of meaning. And you're enunciating it very clearly, even just knowing what does it mean to, in your mind, to think of these words. What you've done then is you've evoked a verbal formation. You've brought up a verbal formation, that's a few words. And that is triggering what's called a volition, an intention. There's something in the mind that's a kind of a thought. And because of that thought, it might happen that arouses for you a feeling. If it arouses a feeling, that feeling will be the sign of metta. Technical term of nimitta for those who know about jhana meditation. Then you just continue. If you catch the wave, if you catch the feeling, pleasant feeling in the body connected to the thought of loving kindness for oneself, you just hang on to that. Just keep watching that. By paying attention to it, you make it a little bit more bright. That's what attention does. And you continue every few seconds to bring that phrase back. That's like an IV drop that stops the mind from wandering, that lifts up the mind again and again, points the mind towards this intention of metta. And see if it's possible to have this feeling in the body to be a little more stabilized. Now, this is going to make your meditation easier than just doing a simple open field of awareness with whatever arises. And the reason for that is that metta normally brings out is a connected to a pleasant feeling. A pleasant feeling is made of endorphin, which is a chemical in the blood. Even though your mind moments will be lasting just for a moment, even though the mind is very unstable and unsteady and the mind wanders here and there and the mind flies about, that chemical that you put in your blood is going to last for about 1 minute. So as you keep coming back again and again with your mental moments and looking, say, looking at this feeling, then the feeling is pleasant. And this is in a way it's a gimmick. But the Buddha used this skill for me. He gave us something that's natural and easy to make this meditation pleasant, so you want to stay in it, so you'll be able to sustain it. And you can take this pleasant feeling and with your imagination spread it throughout the body until every cell in your body is pervaded by a pleasant feeling connected to this intention of metta for yourself. Now, it's for some people, it won't actually be this easy or this simple. Some people might not be able to stay on the thought of metta for herself or for himself. Sometimes we're not able to. Or sometimes people can come into meditation and they get something like a stage fright, and so they can't find a feeling. You know, they just, they don't know the feeling. It's not able to locate a feeling connected to metta. If that's the case, it's probably because there is some kind of a hindrance involved, which is interfering and preventing the meditation. If there's a hindrance, then we need to investigate that. That's the other part of mindfulness. Actually, the more normal part of mindfulness is investigating our hindrances, our problems, our negativities, the dark side, all the things that we have buried inside that will, as we open, go deeper in this practice, they come in, they come up, they come out, they frighten us. And most of the real work of meditation is actually involved with being able to see the whole piece, everything that we have within us, and to see all of it ultimately without being shaken or being upset or disturbed, just knowing that this is part of the package, part of what we got when we took a human birth, is we've got things that are beautiful and pleasant, we've got things that are ugly and horrible. But the metta practice just gives us a taste of what we're heading for. And that's where it gives a little bit of hope. So that if we've got a lot of what they call kilesas, they call obstructive emotional or destructive emotions, or negative things, or traumatic experiences that we have to work with, our meditation practice won't be all difficulty and struggle. Instead, it'll have some sweetness in mind. What we suggest is that for each one of the method that I do is doing metta practice for four persons, oneself, a dear person, that's the beloved person, then a neutral person, and then the difficult person, or the one who's causing us some problems. For each one of these people, there seem to be a different set of hindrances or problems that come up. And the way I suggest doing this is to use real people, not just a sort of a generality, and to really confront and work with and work through whatever is impeding you or hindering you until you've got it solved. For doing metta to oneself, usually the problem is self-hatred. If you have a lot of self-hatred, then it's not so easy to give metta to yourself, because you may think somewhere inside you've learned, maybe I don't really deserve to be happy. I don't deserve to be successful with this meditation practice. And if you've got in you some kind of belief system like that, then it can be really hard to do that metta practice for oneself. A friend of mine who's a psychotherapist works with people who have shame-based traumatic disorders. That would be people who were like sexually abused or something like that in their childhood. And those people have a lot of self-hatred, a lot of internalized shame. And what we, she helped me to clarify that a really powerful antidote to that is called in the ancient text, it's called Charanusati, which is the contemplation of generosity. This is the most amazing thing. We speak to thousands of graduate students, giving them a battery of psychological tests, and we find something out, and then we go back and we read the sutras, and we find, oh, that was discovered 2,600 years ago. What you did that was virtuous, what was generous, what was helpful, is something a person who's got low self-esteem can pick up her self-esteem and become more pleased and happy and comfortable and relaxed with herself when she's out there helping somebody. This is why, like in 12-step rooms, when somebody comes in, the first thing they do is, with a really hardcore addict or something, they give them a job, like they have to set up the chairs. And so they're helping. They're giving something. And that giving is where, that's how they start building up their self-respect and self-esteem. So what I recommend for people who have trouble doing metta for themselves is that they will think about all the good things they did in the day. And not only the positive good things they did by being generous or by being active, but also the good things they did through restraint. So they may think, I didn't have a drink today, if that was my issue. Or they would think, I didn't yell at anybody today. I held my temper today. That was my gift to my family, was I didn't yell at them today. And so just contemplating on those wholesome, beneficial, generous, kind, and nice things that we did. And giving ourselves the gold star for that and honoring ourselves for the good things, that might be something that would be the kind of the trick that fools the mind into relaxing enough to be able to then start doing that metta for herself. For the dear person, it might be greed, in the sense that you want that dear person to love you back. And I frequently suggest contemplating on their death, or your own death, the inevitable separation, as a way to unlock that greed factor that might be the hindrance there. For the neutral person, the most common hindrance is indifference. The reason why they're neutral is because we don't actually care about them. And so we don't find enough energy to do metta. And then for the difficult person, it's a funny thing. The most common problem with the difficult person is a kind of obsession that we get carried away with the story about that person. I think it's related to denial. But you start thinking, oh, may he be happy. He would be a lot happier if he didn't have these irritating problems. And then the mind is sort of like off to the race with that. And so then I suggest a preliminary practice when trying to develop that one to develop a lot of earth element to make the practice like very strong and solid. And the contemplation for that is to do the inner vipassana, inspecting the skeleton, and just visualize, get very clear, like with the strength and stability of your skeleton. And then when you get to what we usually say is do the metta in a sequence to build up the feeling. Don't try to go from zero to loving your enemy. Instead, love yourself, love your dear person, love that neutral person. Then you've got these endorphins flowing through your blood. You have this pleasant feeling going on. Then you visualize your skeleton and visualize making your skeleton like radioactive with love, with loving kindness. So you got this powerful momentum going of a feeling of love and kindness. And then, without even thinking about your difficult person, just put their name in, but don't think about it. And just continue the momentum that way, without thinking about it. I've tried to cover something that I have sometimes taught in a one-day retreat or sometimes in a 10-day retreat. And I've seen it taught as a 10-week program. If you want to do this at home, first of all, if you would like to get a longer presentation, all you need to do is set up a retreat. I'm not far away. You know, it's what I do. And all you've got to do is, if it's 11 o'clock, give me lunch. And we're happy to teach. We don't use money, so it's not difficult to find any monastic. It's very easy to get a monastic to speak about the Dhamma. But if you're interested in this practice, try to develop your Vipassana, develop a mindful awareness in the body, then try to develop metta for yourself where you can get a clear nimitta of the feeling of metta and get stabilized with that you can make it last, say, 20 minutes without losing your meditation. And try to be able to consistently do that. And if you're stuck, it's your practice. You have the right to do whatever it takes to find a way to get over the barrier that's stopping you from loving yourself. And everybody may have different answers to that. But if you've got a barrier that you can't give metta to yourself, you really have to solve it. You can't just, okay, if you can't do metta for yourself, just skip yourself and go think of your puppy or something like that. That's not serving the purpose. So do yourself first until you can. Then do your dear person until you can do it reliably, develop a sitting practice with metta, do it for 20 minutes, and then neutral person, and then difficult person. By the time you master all four of those and the connected problems that might arise from trying to give metta to these four actual beings, then you will have overcome a lot of difficulties, made your practice very strong, very flexible, very able. And then you just keep doing that. Eventually, you may find that you become more easily concentrated. This is going technicalities that I cannot discuss in these couple of minutes, but if you're able to come to access concentration, which is just before full samadhi, that is a state where the practice really opens up and becomes much, much, much more spacious, more stable, bigger, but you're still able to think. You're still able to have a bit more active mind. That's the point where you see this qualitative change in the quality of the meditation. Then you want to do metta for all beings. Then you would do this thing that's so beautifully expressed in the suttas as being like a man who was blowing a conch on top of a mountain, and the sound, the beautiful sound of that horn goes across the valley in all the 10 directions without any impediment and completely fills the world with that sound. And then you're able to let your metta go everywhere to all beings without any obstruction in this very big, spacious way. And then that, if you're interested in practicing what's called sana samadhi in the Eightfold Noble Path of right concentration, that would be one of the ways in which you can then enter into a full concentration. And if you are interested in becoming enlightened, that would be the place that you would develop the further insights related to the progress of your path. I think I've just about used the time that was given to me.
Thank you so much.